mare. One morning, when Enrique was 8, he was helping his father, who was hungover and working under the truck. His father called for his son to find him a tool. Enrique had no idea what the tool was. Under the truck, his father grew angry. Enrique spun about, searching without knowing what he was looking for. His father cursed him. Enrique began to cry in desperation. His father crawled out from under the truck. Enrique ran off. His father chased him down and beat him. Enrique had never beaten an animal the way he was beaten that day. He cried himself to sleep that night, angry that his mother hadn't defended him, hating life and his father. He heard people say they were happy in their poverty, but Enrique never knew anybody poor who was anything but miserable. An unbridgeable river seemed to separate the toad from the world. In the toad, poverty pitted villagers against each other in a vicious battle for an upper hand. Enrique milked cows for another farmer. He was paid 2 liters of milk a day and 10 pesos a week, and with it endured the kicks and insults from the farmer's son, who was his age. Once, when Enrique was sick, his mother took him to a hospital in Topeak. He stared at perfumed women, and men in new cars, and children with new clothes. The city was only a few miles from his rancho, but it seemed a distant land on the other side of that river. Enrique grew older and went to school. There he learned to hate his teachers like his mother hated rain. They treated kids from the village's upper barrio with respect, but spoke sharply to the ragged children who came up from the toad without food for lunch. To the upper barrio kids, the teachers awarded prizes of candy and toys that no one from the toad had a chance of winning. Some teachers forbade the toad kids from going to the bathroom until they wet themselves. A few teachers showed up drunk. Others didn't show up for weeks at a time. Enrique's father mocked him for not knowing his multiplication tables. But how could he know them with teachers like these? Life held one thrill. His mother's brothers were up in Los Angeles working, which gave his family a connection that other kids envied. Villagers spoke of his uncles like far-off explorers and traded their latest news. Enrique didn't let on to his friends that his father never got along with these uncles. There had been a fight years before, in which his father had been knifed, and 2 people on his uncle's side of the family died. His father married into the family, but he and his brothers-in-law never liked each other. Then one day news spread that an uncle was returning from the San Fernando Valley. Relatives thrilled at the gifts he would bring. That day, mothers washed their kids and lined them up in anticipation. The uncle, remembering the feud with Enrique's father, had gifts for everyone but Enrique, his sisters, and his mother. The children went home in tears of incomprehension. Life improved only slowly. Somehow his mother saved enough to buy a cow, and finally they were ranchers of a sort, and worked harder because of it. Enrique went to bed dreaming of life as a respected ranchero. For a while, he thought he glimpsed a future as a cop. Highway patrolman looked like an exciting job, but his father had no political connections to get him into the academy. "Besides," said his father, "I need an agronomist, not a patrolman. Remember, one day this land will be yours. Your sisters will get married and go live with their husbands. You'll inherit the land and the house." Enrique's father held that promise over him, and soon it seemed more like a threat. Enrique saw farmers like his father draining their lives into those fields. They remained the same ignorant, violent, cold men stuck in poverty, controlled by others. Escaping this fate became Enrique's greatest concern. His urgency intensified when he spotted a girl. She was 12 and beautiful. Her father was a butcher in town. That placed her in the upper classes of the rancho, well above Enrique's station as the son of an alcoholic sugarcane farmer. She lived up the hill, which was more than just geographically above the toad. The kids from that barrio had parents who owned stores, slightly better houses, and more land. They ruled the town playground and ran off kids from the toad with rocks. Enrique knew he could give this girl none of the life she and her father expected for her. But when he asked her to be his girlfriend, she accepted. Theirs was a chaste village romance, filled with kisses and hugs. For it to become more than that, Enrique knew he would have to get moving. Then his mother went to California for a few months. She returned with gifts, but also with the news that one of her brothers had been killed by a police officer overstepping his authority, she said. People in the village accepted that story. His remaining uncles up north, whose anger at Enrique's mother for having married his father had subsided, sent Enrique his first clothes from America. Villagers viewed these men as heroes. Some asked his uncles for help getting north. Enrique imagined his uncles were grand men in a place called Canoga Park. His mother found work overseeing the village school's lunch program, so Enrique no longer went hungry at school. His father was elected treasurer of the local sugarcane farmers' cooperative. He oversaw the installation of the first village streetlights. It surprised Enrique to see his father so diligent about putting in village light poles, while he brought so much darkness home. Then junior high ended. Enrique attempted high school in Topeka. He spent 2 weeks there, each day without anything to eat for lunch, before he ran out of bus money and withdrew. The threat of a life in the fields now seemed frighteningly real. Toiling in the cane would never allow him to give his girl what she and her father expected for her. In the village, girls married young. Though she was only 13, Enrique had no time to lose. Plumbing was at last coming to the village. Now townsfolk could get drinking water from the faucet instead of from distant wells. Toilets would replace the hills. But Enrique thought only of his uncles in Canoga Park. So he made plans, and he kept them to himself. He'd get to Tijuana, find a coyote to take him to Canoga Park. He had no address or phone number for his uncles, but surely they were so well known that they'd be easy to find. One day he walked through the village, greeted his friends, spent time with his girlfriend, and said farewell to no one. The next, he took a birth certificate and put on his best black jacket, one that his uncles had sent to him, a white-collared shirt and blue pants, kissed his mother, and said he'd be back later that day. He went to Tepeque and boarded Tres Estrellas de Oro, the low-cost bus line that over the years took north hundreds of thousands of Mexicans intending to cross. He paid for the ticket with 200 pesos he had swiped from his parents. He considered the money a loan, so he wouldn't feel bad for taking it. He sat by the window for 28 hours so he could see all the things he had never seen before. It was 1989, and he was 14. The Molecule. Andy Coop very nearly spent his career watching paint dry. The son of a machinist and school cafeteria worker, Coop hailed from Halifax in northern England. He finished his undergraduate work in chemistry at Oxford University in 1991. He was given a choice of where to continue his studies. At Cardiff University was a professor whose specialty was the chemistry of paint. Industry at the time was aiming to find a new paint that dried at a certain temperature. At the University of Bristol was John Lewis, who discovered the chemistry of drugs and addiction. In the 1960s, Lewis had discovered buprenorphine, an opiate that he later helped develop into a treatment for heroin addicts. Coop didn't remember giving the choice much thought. Drugs sounded more interesting than paint was all, so off to Bristol and John Lewis he went. It was there, in 1991, in a lab at Bristol, that Andy Coop encountered the morphine molecule, the essential element in all opiates. In time, Andy Coop got hooked on the morphine molecule. Figuratively, of course, for he only once took a drug that contained it, and that following surgery. I looked up Andy Coop because I wanted to understand the molecule behind the story that consumed me. Like no other particle on Earth, the morphine molecule seemed to possess heaven and hell. It allowed for modern surgery, saving and improving too many lives to count. It stunted and ended too many lives to count with addiction and overdose. Discussing it, you could invoke some of humankind's greatest cultural creations and deepest questions. Faust, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, discussions on the fundamental nature of man and human behavior, of free will and slavery, of God and evolution. Studying the molecule, you naturally wandered into questions like, can mankind achieve happiness without pain? Would that happiness even be worth it? Can we have it all? I might have loved paint, Coop told me, but the conversation over evolution, heaven and hell, psychology, none of that matters when you're studying paint. In Heroin Addicts, I have seen the debasement that comes from the loss of free will and enslavement to what amounts to an idea, permanent pleasure, numbness, and the avoidance of pain. But man's decay has always begun as soon as he had it all, and is free of friction, pain, and the deprivation that temper his behavior. In fact, the United States achieved something like this state of affairs in the period this book is about, the last decade of the 20th century and the first decade of the 21st century. When I returned home from Mexico during those years, I noticed a scary obesity emerging. It wasn't just the people. Everything seemed obese and excessive. Massive Hummers and SUVs were cars on steroids. In some of the Southern California suburbs near where I grew up, on plots laid out with three-bedroom houses in the 1950s, 7,000-square-foot mansions barely squeezed between the lot lines, leaving no place for yards in which to enjoy the California sun. In Northern California's Humboldt and Mendocino counties, 1960s hippies became the last great American pioneers by escaping their parents' artificial world. They lived in teepees without electricity and funded the venture by growing pot. Now their children and grandchildren, like mad scientists, were using chemicals and 1,000-watt bulbs and railroad cars buried to avoid detection to forge hyperpotent strains of pot. Their weed rippled like the muscles of bodybuilders, and growing this stuff helped destroy the natural world that their parents once sought. Excess contaminated the best of America. Caltech churned out brilliant students, yet too many of them now went not to science but to Wall Street to create financial gimmicks that paid off handsomely and produced nothing. Exorbitant salaries, meanwhile, were paid to Wall Street and corporate executives, no matter how poorly they did. Banks packaged rolls of bad mortgages, and we believed Standard & Poor's when they called them AAA. Well-off parents no longer asked their children to work when they became teenagers. In Mexico, I gained new appreciation of what America means to a poor person limited by his own humble origins. I took great pride that America had turned more poor Mexicans into members of the middle class than had Mexico. Then I would return home and see too much of the country turning on this legacy in pursuit of comfort, living on credit, attempting to achieve happiness through more stuff. And I saw no coincidence that this was also when great new numbers of these same kids, most of them well-off and white, began consuming huge quantities of the morphine molecule, doping up and tuning out. I looked up Andy Coop, who chairs the Department of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of Maryland in Baltimore. What gave the morphine molecule its immense power, he said, was that it evolved somehow to fit, key and lock, into the receptors that all mammals, especially humans, have in their brains and spines. The so-called mu-opioid receptors, designed to create pleasure sensations when they received endorphins the body naturally produces, were especially welcoming to the morphine molecule. The receptor combines with endorphins to give us those glowing feelings at, say, the sight of an infant or the feel of a furry puppy. The morphine molecule overwhelms the receptor, creating a far more intense euphoria than anything we come by internally. It also produces drowsiness, constipation, and an end to physical pain. Aspirin had a limit to the amount of pain it could calm. But the more morphine you took, Coop said, the more pain was dulled. For this reason, no plant has been more studied for its medical properties than the opium poppy. As the mature poppy's petals fall away, a golf ball-sized bulb emerges atop the stem. The bulb houses a goo that contains opium. From opium, humans have derived laudanum, codeine, thebaine, hydrocodone, oxymorphone, and heroin, as well as almost 200 other drugs, all containing the morphine molecule or variations of it. Etorphine, derived from thebaine, is used in dart guns, had tranquilized rhinoceroses and elephants. Tobacco, coca leaves, and other plants had evolved to be pleasurable and addictive to humans, Coop said. But the morphine molecule surpassed them in euphoric intensity. Then, it exacted a mighty vengeance when a human dared to stop using it. In withdrawal from the drug, an addict left narcotized numbness and returned to life and to feeling. Numbed addicts were notoriously impotent. In withdrawal, they had frequent orgasms as they began to feel again. Humans with the temerity to attempt to withdraw from the morphine molecule were tormented first with excruciating pain that lasted for days. If an addict was always constipated and nodding off, his withdrawals brought ferocious diarrhea and a week of sleeplessness. The morphine molecule resembled a spoiled lover, throwing a tantrum as it left. Junkies I talked to, in fact, said they had an almost constipated tingling when trying to urinate during the end of withdrawal, as if the last of the molecule, now holed up in the kidney, was fighting like hell to keep from being expelled. Like a lover, no other molecule in nature provided such merciful pain relief, then hooked humans so completely, and punished them so mercilessly for wanting their freedom from it. Certain parasites in nature exert the kind of control that makes a host act contrary to its own interests. One protozoan, Toxoplasma gondii, reproduces inside the belly of a cat and is then excreted by the feline. One way it begins the cycle again is to infect a rat passing near the excrement. Toxoplasma gondii reprograms the infected rat to love cat urine, which to healthy rats is a predator warning. An infected rat wallows in cat urine, offering itself up as an easy meal to a nearby cat. This way, the parasite again enters the cat's stomach, reproduces, and is expelled in the cat's excrement, and the cycle continues. The morphine molecule exerts an analogous brainwashing on humans, pushing them to act contrary to their self-interest in pursuit of the molecule. Addicts betray loved ones, steal, live under freeways in harsh weather, and run similarly horrific risks to use the molecule. It became the poster molecule for an age of excess. No amount of it was ever enough. The molecule created ever higher tolerance. Plus, it had a way of railing on when the body gathered the courage to throw it out. This wasn't only during withdrawals. Most drugs are easily reduced to water-soluble glucose in the human body, which then expels them. Alone in nature, the morphine molecule rebelled. It resisted being turned into glucose, and it stayed in the body. We still can't explain why this happens. It just doesn't follow the rules. Every other drug in the world, thousands of them, follows this rule. Morphine doesn't, Coop said. It really is almost like someone designed it that way. Diabolically so. Delivered like pizza. Denver, Colorado. In 1979, a young man fell into a job at the Denver Police Department. He was new in town, fresh from a broken engagement in his native Pueblo, Colorado. Dennis Chavez never meant to be a cop. His family traced its roots back to a 17th century Spanish conquistador. 4 centuries later, Chavez's father was a steelworker in Pueblo. Chavez, a big guy, played football at the University of Colorado for a couple of years in the 1970s before leaving the school. He worked construction. Then a friend recently hired on at Denver PD told him the work was fun and urged him to take the entrance test. Chavez passed it, and within a few months was at the Denver Police Academy. Early into his first year on patrol, however, a training officer told his friend that Chavez was failing, probably the dumbest in the new recruit class, and almost certain to wash out before the year ended. That irked. Chavez put in extra time studying laws and the municipal code, exercising and adding new energy to his street work. In time, his interest in sports channeled into power weightlifting. He cut his hair in a flat top, with lightning bolts cut into the sides and his badge number on the back of his head. Steroids were legal then. He would buy bodybuilding dope from a doctor who visited the gym where he lifted. Soon he was spending $1,200 a month on steroids and supplements. He was 6'4", 250 pounds, and muscles bulged from him as if his body were a squeezed balloon. Dennis Chavez was a ferocious cat back then, shaking hands with an iron grip, clubbing friends on the shoulders when he saw them. He arrived at every 911 call like a pit bull, pulling for action. When he barked, "How you doing?" at friends, it sounded like a cross between an interrogation and a command. Even cops tried to avoid him. He was obsessed with his job, which he took to mean arresting bad guys. A lieutenant once criticized him for not writing enough tickets. As training officer to new recruits, the lieutenant said, Chavez wasn't showing them enough balance to his police work. "That's not what I do," Chavez told the lieutenant. "I find felons." He spent his first years in the force learning from a cop named Robert Wallace. Wallace was the department's version of a super cop. He made major arrests all the time. He and his partner were involved in more than a dozen shootings, which to Chavez meant that Wallace was always getting in the way of the worst bad guys. Wallace was a guy he wanted to emulate. Wallace taught him about prison tattoos and recognizing the look of a guy in the lam in line at a downtown shelter. From Wallace, Chavez learned early on that most crime is connected to illegal drugs, so understanding that world was crucial to good police work. Heroin particularly interested Chavez. Back then, Mexican-American families controlled the trade in Denver. But as Chavez worked them and arrested them, he heard they were being supplied by men from a place in Mexico called Nayarit. The name meant nothing to Chavez, but for years it kept coming up. The Nayarit sold a substance he hadn't seen before. Heroin in Denver up to then had been all light brown powder. This Nayarit heroin, however, was dark and sticky and looked like Tootsie Rolls or rat feces. They called it black tar, and Chavez heard stories they'd cut it with boiled down Coca-Cola. As the years passed, meanwhile, what Dennis Chavez realized he loved most about his job was the deduction of crime. It was the immersion in it, finding the thread of a criminal and his M.O. Once, a serial rapist was striking across Denver. Chavez had taken the statement of the last victim, a high school girl who, in tears, grabbed his hand and made him promise that he would catch the guy. Victims said the rapist held a buck knife to them as he assaulted them. Chavez charted the rapist's attacks, his times, dates, locations. He staked out the southeast Denver neighborhood where he thought the guy would hit next. One night he saw a man walking down an alley and just knew it was the guy. Then the man jaywalked. Chavez stopped him and arrested him for carrying a concealed buck knife in his pants. Victims came to the station house that night and identified Chavez's arrestee as their rapist. A few years into the job, Dennis Chavez woke one morning unable to see, his heart pounding like an overheated piston. His girlfriend took him to the hospital. A doctor told him he was going to have a stroke if he didn't let up. "You can die young and good-looking, or years from now, fat and happy," the doctor said. Dennis Chavez opted for the latter. He backed off the steroids and coffee and stopped powerlifting. He took up Aikido and long rides into the Colorado mountains on his Harley. Later, he founded a club of officers who rode motorcycles and raised money for charities. He mellowed. His police work changed, too. His affinity for sleuthing didn't flag, but no longer the pit bull, he had to develop other skills. Among these was the cultivation of snitches, and with that, a personality that other people wanted to be around. Finding informants was not hard, really. He'd arrest a guy and tell him he could work off the case by setting up others. Eventually, that could lead to cash payments to the informant. What was hard was managing the relationship, particularly when the informant went from working off his case to making a salary from it. The best snitches were the ones who stayed in it and would do anything for their handlers. These relationships required finesse and a soothing personality that let an informant know that Chavez liked him and would protect him. It meant going against the book from time to time, accepting Christmas presents, for example, and giving them in return. Informants became particularly important when, in 1995, Dennis Chavez joined the narcotics unit of the Denver Police Department. He was bequeathed his first long-term informant by a sergeant leaving the unit. The sergeant introduced Chavez to a man immersed in Denver's Mexican heroin underworld. Chavez never had much connection to Mexico. His father had forbidden Spanish in the house, so his children wouldn't speak accented English. But Chavez could see the Denver drug world changing. Mexican-American dealer families were going to prison, dying, moving away. Mexicans stepped into the void, and when that happened, Chavez began hearing about the state of Nayarit all the time. The heroin in Denver was all black tar now. In the late 1980s, he saw guys from Nayarit walking around downtown selling heroin to anyone who'd walk up to them. He arrested many of them and found Nayarit on a map, but it still didn't mean much. He saw them move into cars and drive it around to customers. Mexicans were arrested at the bus stations with backpacks and a kilo or two of the drug. But Chavez still had no sense for how this fit together, if it did at all. Until one day, when his informant said to him, "You know they're all from the same town, right?" I met Dennis Chavez at a Mexican restaurant in North Denver, where he told me the story of how he began tracking the Nayarit heroin connection. He said he was intrigued by what the informant told him, that all that he was seeing related to heroin in Denver originated in one small town in Mexico. He prodded the man for more. What Chavez had been seeing on the streets, the informant said, the dealers, the couriers with backpacks of heroin, the drivers with balloons of heroin, all looks very random and scattered, but it's not. It's all connected. They're all from a town called Jalisco. Jalisco, he said, pronouncing the word. Don't confuse it with a state in Mexico pronounced the same way but spelled with a J. The state of Jalisco is one of Mexico's largest, and Guadalajara is its capital. This town, he said, spells its name with an X. The informant had never been there, but believed it to be a small place. All these guys running around Denver selling black tar heroin are from this town of Jalisco, or a few small villages near there, the informant told Chavez. Their success is based on a system they've learned. It's a system for selling heroin retail. Their system is a simple thing, really, and relies on cheap, illegal Mexican labor, just the way any fast food joint does. From then on, Chavez sat with the informant, at bars and in a truck outside the man's house, as the informant talked on about these guys from Jalisco and their heroin retail system, which was unlike anything the informant had seen in the drug underworld. "Think of it like a fast food franchise," the informant said, "like a pizza delivery service. Every heroin cell or franchise has an owner in Jalisco, Nayarit, who supplies the cell with heroin. The owner doesn't often come to the United States. He communicates only with the cell manager, who lives in Denver and runs the business for him. Beneath the cell manager is a telephone operator," the informant said. "The operator stays in an apartment all day and takes calls. The calls come from addicts ordering their dope. Under the operator are several drivers, paid a weekly wage and given housing and food. Their job is to drive the city with their mouths full of little uninflated balloons of black tar heroin, 25 or 30 at a time in one mouth. They look like chipmunks. They have a bottle of water at the ready, so if police pull them over, they swig the water and swallow the balloons. The balloons remain intact in the body and are eliminated in the driver's waste. Apart from the balloon in their mouths, drivers keep another 100 hidden somewhere in the car. The operator's phone number is circulated among heroin addicts, who call with their orders. The operator's job, the informant said, is to tell them where to meet the driver. Some suburban shopping center parking lot, a McDonald's, a Wendy's, a CVS pharmacy. The operators relay the message to the driver, the informant said. The driver swings by the parking lot and the addict pulls out to follow him, usually down side streets. Then the driver stops. The addict jumps into the driver's car. There, in broken English and broken Spanish, a cross-cultural heroin deal is accomplished, with the driver spitting out the balloons the addict needs and taking his cash. Drivers do this all day, the guy said. Business hours, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. usually. A cell of drivers at first can quickly gross $5,000 a day. Within a year, that cell can be clearing $15,000 daily. The system operates on certain principles, the informant said, and the Nayarit traffickers don't violate them. The cells compete with each other, but competing drivers know each other from back home, so they're never violent. They never carry guns. They work hard at blending in. They don't party where they live. They drive sedans that are several years old. None of the workers use the drug. Drivers spend a few months in a city, and then the bosses send them home or to a cell in another town. The cells switch cars about as often as they switch drivers. New drivers are coming up all the time, usually farm boys from Jalisco County. The cell owners like young drivers because they're less likely to steal from them. The more experienced a driver becomes, the more likely he knows how to steal from the boss. The informant assumed there were thousands of these kids back in Nayarit, aching to come north and drive some U.S. city with their mouths packed with heroin balloons. "To a degree unlike any other narcotics operation," he said, "Jalisco cells run like small businesses. The cell owner pays each driver a salary. $1,200 a week was the going rate in Denver at the time. The cell owner holds each driver to exact expenses, demanding receipts for how much each spent for lunch or for a hooker. Drivers are encouraged to offer special deals to addicts to drum up business, $15 per balloon or $7 for $100. A free balloon on Sunday to an addict who buys Monday through Saturday. Selling heroin a tenth of a gram at a time is their one and only full-time, 7 days a week job, and that includes Christmas Day. Heroin addicts need their dope every day. Cell profits were based on the markup inherent in retail. Their customers were strung-out, desperate junkies who couldn't afford a half a kilo of heroin. Anyone looking for a large amount of heroin was probably a cop aiming for a case that would land the dealer in prison for years. Asked to buy a large quantity of dope, the informant said, and they'd shut down their phones. You'd never hear from them again. That really startled the informant. He knew of no other Mexican trafficking group that preferred to sell tiny quantities. Moreover, the Jalisco cells never deal with African Americans. They don't sell to black people, nor do they buy from blacks, who they fear will rob them. They sell almost exclusively to whites. What the informant described, Chavez could see, amounted to a major innovation in the U.S. drug underworld. These innovations had every bit the impact of those in the legitimate business world. When, for example, someone discovered that cocaine cooked with water and baking soda became rock hard, the smokable cocaine known as crack was born. Crack was a more effective delivery system for cocaine, sending it straight to the brain. The Jalisco traffickers' innovation was literally a delivery mechanism as well. Guys from Jalisco had figured out that what white people, especially middle-class white kids, want most is service, convenience. They didn't want to go to Skid Row or some seedy dope house to buy their drugs. Now they didn't need to. The guys from Jalisco would deliver it to them. So the system spread. By the mid-1990s, Chavez's informant counted a dozen major metro areas in the western United States where cells from tiny Jalisco Nayarit operated. In Denver, by then he could count 8 or 10 cells, each with 3 or 4 drivers, working daily. As I listened to Chavez, it seemed to me that the guys from Jalisco were fired by the impulse that, in fact, moved so many Mexican immigrants. Most Mexican immigrants spent years in the United States not melting in, but imagining instead the day when they would go home for good. This was their American dream, to return to Mexico better off than they had left it, and show everyone back home that that's how it was. They called home and sent money constantly. They were usually far more involved in, say, the digging of a new well in the rancho, than in the workings of the school their children attended in the United States. They returned home for the village's annual fiesta and spent money they couldn't afford on barbecues, weddings, and quinceañeras. To that end, as they worked the toughest jobs in America, they assiduously built houses in the ranchos back home that stood as monuments to their desire to return for good one day. Their houses took a decade to finish. Immigrants added to their houses each time they returned. They invariably extended rebar from the top of their houses' first floors. Rebar was a promise that as soon as he got the money together, the owner was adding a second story. Rods of rebar, standing at attention, became part of the skyline in literally thousands of Mexican immigrant villages and ranchos. The finished houses of migrant Mexico often had wrought iron gates, modern plumbing, and marble floors. These towns slowly improved as they emptied of people whose dream was to build their houses too. Over the years, the towns became dreamlands, as empty as movie sets, where immigrants went briefly to relax at Christmas or during the annual fiesta, and imagine their lives as wealthy retirees back home again one day. The great irony was that work, mortgages, and U.S.-born children kept most migrants from ever returning to Mexico to live permanently in those houses they built with such sacrifice. But the Jalisco heroin traffickers did it all the time. Their story was about immigration and what moves a poor Mexican to migrate, as much as it was a tale of drug trafficking. Those Jalisco traffickers who didn't end up in prison went back to live in those houses. They put down no roots in this country. They spent as little money in America as they could, in fact. Jamaicans, Russians, Italians, even other Mexican traffickers, all bought property and broadcasted their wealth in the United States. The Jalisco traffickers were the only immigrant narcotics mafia Chavez knew of that aimed to just go home, and with nary a shot fired. Denver became a Jalisco hub as their operations expanded. And probably no cop in America learned more about them than Dennis Chavez. By the time I met him, hundreds of arrests and sweeping federal indictments had not stopped them. They had spread like a virus, quietly and unrecognized by many in law enforcement, who often mistook Jalisco franchises for isolated groups of small-time dealers. "I call them the Jalisco boys," Chavez said. "They're nationwide." Enrique alone. Tijuana, Mexico. Chaotic Tijuana was the biggest city Enrique had ever seen. Thousands of people flowed like a river through the central bus station before crossing into the United States. The station roiled with humble, hungry folks from ranchos like his. Boys darted in and out of traffic, washing windshields for change. Men who'd tried to cross and were turned back had fallen into alcohol. They reminded Enrique of the drunks in the rancho. Enrique slept on the bus terminal's chairs and wandered the city streets during the day. He found a coyote and asked the price to a place called Canoga Park. When he told the man he had no address for his uncle's, he figured he'd just ask around. The coyote laughed. "Canoga Park is huge. It's not like your rancho." Still, he hung on in Tijuana, fearing to return home a failure. He washed in the bus station bathroom, every morning looking more like a Tijuana urchin. Finally, famished, his prized clothes filthy and stinking and his money almost gone, he dialed the village's telephone in tears. His departure was the talk of the rancho. Uncles and aunts crowded around the phone. On a second call, his hysterical mother answered. She gave him a number for uncles in Los Angeles who were coming for him. They arrived and arranged for him to cross the border, posing as the son of a man with papers. 2 mornings later, Enrique was sitting in an uncle's apartment in Canoga Park in the San Fernando Valley. "Now," the uncle said, "I'll give you $1,000 and a suitcase and you'll go home." "No, what I want from life you can't buy with $1,000. His uncles took him to eat and then to another apartment. One uncle opened a closet, and there, like a glorious revelation, were dozens of pairs of Levi's 501s with labels and price tags attached. "Take what you want." With that, the boy who had never had more than 2 threadbare pairs of pants now had his first new, tough dark blue 501s. 501s marked his first time up north. Much later, he would remember the first time he bought a pair for himself in America, and then the first time he came home wearing 501s. Back home, villagers, and Enrique himself, had always assumed his uncles were working hard in some honorable trade up in the great El Norte, one that paid enough to fund bountiful gifts every time they returned. Now they sat him down. One uncle pulled out a shoebox filled with golf-sized chunks of a dark, sticky substance and balloons of every color. "What's that?" Enrique asked. "Chiva," his uncle said. "Goat, the Mexican slang term for black tar heroin. This is how we make our money." Cora Indian campesinos grew the poppies in the mountains above Jalisco. They harvested the opium goo from the flowers and sold it to cookers whom Enrique's uncles knew. A newly cooked kilo of vinegary, sticky chiva would head north in a boombox or a backpack within a couple days, virtually uncut, and often hit L.A. streets only a week after the goo was drawn from the poppy. As Enrique's uncle spoke, he rolled little pieces of the gunk into balls the size of BBs. He put each one in a tiny balloon and tied each balloon. Finally, he wrapped the telephone in a towel to muffle the ring. As Enrique was wondering why, the uncle plugged in the phone, and the call started coming and never stopped. "These are customers," his uncle explained over the ringing. "We have guys out there driving around all day with these balloons. We give each caller a different intersection to meet a driver. Then we beep a driver the code for the intersection where that customer will be. We do this all day long." "We wouldn't have told you had you not showed up," his uncle said. "But now that you're here..." Enrique saw his chance. He begged to work for them. "You're too young," said one uncle. "You need to go to school, or we send you home." But Enrique pleaded, and finally the uncles relented. They put him to work driving the place most Angelenos refer to simply as the Valley. The San Fernando Valley comprises 260 square miles, larger than Chicago, and contains the sprawling northern chunk of Los Angeles. At its west end is Canoga Park, a district of 60,000 people, bisected by boulevards with palm trees. Classic, modest, suburban ranch-style houses made of stucco line its residential streets. For years after it emerged from citrus groves in the 1950s, Canoga Park and the Valley had been famously white, with only small islands of Mexican-American barrios. But the mass migration of Mexicans to Southern California and the end of the Cold War changed the area. Defense contractors departed, so did many white people. Soon, districts of Los Angeles such as Van Nuys, Reseda, North Hollywood, and Canoga Park were largely Mexican. Those changes were beginning as Enrique arrived. Though 14, Enrique was tall enough not to arouse suspicion behind the wheel. He drove the streets of the San Fernando Valley with his mouth full of tiny balloons, following beeps from his uncles. He learned where Canoga Park ended and West Hills began. He trolled those palm tree-lined boulevards, Sherman Way, Roscoe, and Sepulveda, that were wider than the highways back home. Those first few weeks he remembered like a fairy tale, as if everything he had heard about America were true. Money, clothes, and good food seemed as plentiful as the sunshine. At the apartment, he turned on a VCR and a porno film leaped to life. His uncles ate often at El Tapatio and Pocos, a seafood restaurant. They drank at the Majestic, a bar that Nayarit immigrants frequented. As long as Enrique was with them, the waitresses served him beer. His idea of becoming a state trooper evaporated, as did any thought of school. After a few months, the uncles installed Enrique in an apartment on DeSoto Avenue and gave him the keys to two cars. He would run the business, roll the heroin into balloons, take calls, direct drivers on the street. The phone rang all day until he shut it down at 8 p.m. As he turned 15, he was taking orders for $5,000 worth of heroin a day. The apartment's closets filled with stolen 501s and VCRs and porno films that addicts exchanged for dope. Enrique no longer had to worry about his jeans fading when he washed them. There were always more. He showered with fragrant shampoo and exchanged the village pond for the swimming pool at an uncle's house in a neighborhood full of Americans. His clients were nurses and lawyers. One of his best clients was a wealthy lawyer. Prostitutes, former soldiers who'd been to Vietnam, old junkies from the barrio, and young cholos. One day he was at an uncle's house and the phone rang. A caller from home. His uncle's face clouded. "Problemas," he said, his hand over the mouthpiece. Problemas. Problems. The word seems so nondescript. But in the ranchos of Mexico, it is a euphemism for tangled webs of murder and lawlessness. Problemas were shootings and feuds that grew from a chance word, a property dispute, a theft of a sister for marriage. Problemas kept rancheros poor and fleeing north to the United States. Some great amount of the migration to the United States was due more to problemas, escaping murder, fleeing feuds, than to simple economics and poverty. Problemas could empty a rancho in less than a generation. Sometimes a village would see the problems die out only to be reignited by a chance meeting of old enemies on a bus or a street corner years later. Rancho dances in particular bred problemas. At dances, people drank, and sex and machismo roiled just beneath the surface. In some towns, the saying was, baile el viernes, cuerpo el sábado, dance Friday night, body Saturday morning. A shooting at a dance could embitter a family against another for years. Keeping track of the bewildering history of conflicts became an essential ranchero survival skill. Something like this had divided the family of Enrique's mother. Enrico never knew the cause of the feud between the two sides of his mother's family, nor why his grandparents had married if the problemas were so serious. But the feud would come and go like bad weather. The phone call that morning in Canoga Park brought news that it had come again. A mass shooting in the village. 2 were dead, 15 wounded. One side of his mother's family was to blame. The victims were mostly from the other side. News of the shootings mainly served to remind Enrique of why he was in Canoga Park selling drugs. Back home, drug users were the moral equivalents of pedophiles. But drug sales were his pathway out of problemas. He saw day workers on Sherman Way, exploited, sometimes not paid, yet that wasn't treated as a crime. They tried to work the right way, and look what happened. He wasn't forcing anyone to buy his dope. With that thought, and the problemas he was escaping, he felt peace, and the 501s didn't hurt either. For 7 months he worked for his uncles in Canoga Park. Finally, they packed him a suitcase and gave him $2,000 for all his labor and sent him home. He thought he was due more, but the rancho's ethos of poverty reigned, even the San Fernando Valley. They could exploit him, so they did, and he couldn't object. Heroin had not changed that. In fact, he thought his uncles remained cautious villagers in many ways. They had been in the San Fernando Valley for almost a decade, yet they still ran their business for a few months, made some money, and shut it down, less afraid of the police than of what people back home would say. Dozens of villagers welcomed Enrique home to his isolated rancho in the Toad, a few miles outside the town of Jalisco, Nayarit. The poor kid from the Toad was now admired as the only village boy to cross the border alone. He gave his money to his mother, keeping $200. He bought a bottle of Cazadores tequila, and the party that night was big. Older folks besieged him with questions. A few friends took him aside and asked for help finding the kind of work he was doing. He put them off, but saw that apparently word had spread more than his uncles had realized. He wanted to get back to California himself in a few months. He was only 15, and people were coming to him for favors. It was a luxurious feeling, and he bathed in     it. As the night mingled with tequila and took the edge off the stifling heat, the stereo played his favorite corrido, El Número Uno, by Los Incomparables de Tijuana. Enrique pulled his Beretta 9mm and howled as he held it high and fired it into the air. The Poppy. The story of the opium poppy is almost as old as man. Opium was likely our first drug, as agricultural civilizations formed near rivers. Mesopotamians grew the poppy at Tigris and Euphrates. The Assyrians invented the method, still widely used today, of slicing and draining the poppy's pod of the goo containing opium. The Sumerians, the world's first civilization and agriculturalists, used the ideograms hull and gill for the poppy, translating it as the joy plant, wrote Martin Booth in his classic Opium, A History. The ancient Egyptians first produced opium as a drug. Thebaine, an opium derivative, is named for Thebes, the Egyptian city that was the first great center of opium poppy production. Indians also grew the poppy and used opium. So did the Greeks. Homer and Virgil mention opium and potions derived from it. The expanding Arab Empire and later the Venetians, both inveterate traders, helped spread the drug. Early civilizations saw opium as an antidote to the burdens of life, to sorrow and to pain, and as an effective sleep inducer. They also knew it as lethally poisonous and intensely habit-forming, but its benefits made the risks easy to overlook. In the early 1800s, a German pharmacist apprentice named Friedrich Sauterner isolated the sleep-inducing element in opium and named it morphine for Morpheus, the Greek god of sleep and dreams. Morphine was more potent than simple opium and killed more pain. War spread the morphine molecule through the 19th century. More than 330 wars broke out, forcing countries to learn to produce morphine. The U.S. Civil War prompted the planting of opium poppies in Virginia, Georgia, and South Carolina for the first time, and bequeathed the country thousands of morphine-addicted soldiers. Two 19th-century wars were over the morphine molecule itself, and whether China could prevent the sale on her own soil of India-grown opium. The drug provided huge revenues essential to the British Empire, and was one of their few products for which the self-sufficient Chinese showed an appetite. That it lost two of these opium wars to the British explains China's infamous and widespread opium problem in 1900, where only moderate numbers of addicts existed in 1840. In 1853, meanwhile, an Edinburgh doctor named Alexander Wood invented the hypodermic needle, a delivery system superior to both eating the pills and the then popular anal suppositories. Needles allowed more accurate dosing. Wood and other doctors also believed needles would literally remove the patient's appetite for the drug, which no longer had to be eaten. This proved incorrect. Wood's wife became the first recorded overdose death from an injected opiate. In the United States, more opium came with newly addicted Chinese immigrants, who smoked it in back alley dens within Chinatowns in San Francisco and elsewhere. Opium dens were outlawed, and after Chinese immigration was made illegal, the practice of smoking opium eventually declined too. Morphine replaced it. Patent medicines with morphine and opium, meanwhile, were sold as miracle cures. These elixirs were branded with names evoking quaint home remedies. Opium was the active ingredient in, for example, Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup, which was used to pacify children. These remedies were marketed aggressively in newspapers and popular media. Patent medicine sales exploded, rising from $3.5 million in 1859 to almost $75 million by the 20th century. In London in 1874, Dr. Adler Wright was attempting to find a non-addictive form of morphine when he synthesized a drug that he called diacetylmorphine, a terrific painkiller. In 1898, a Bayer laboratory chemist in Germany, Heinrich Dresser, reproduced Wright's diacetylmorphine and called it heroin, for heroisch, German for heroic. The word that Bayer workers used to describe how it made them feel when Dresser tested it on them. Heroin was at first believed to be non-addictive. Heroin pills were marketed as a remedy for coughs and respiratory ailments. With tuberculosis a public health threat, this was no small point. As junkies ever since had discovered, heroin is an effective constipator and was thus marketed as an anti-diarrheal. Women used it, on doctor's orders, for menstrual cramps and respiratory problems. Doctors didn't have much else to prescribe for pain or disease. Thus, addiction exploded to a drug that people believed was safe because doctors said so. This aroused U.S. public opinion, which forced the passage of the Harrison Narcotics Tax Act of 1914. The law taxed and regulated opiates and coca leaf products, while allowing doctors to use them in the practice of medicine. But it was transformed into America's first prohibition statute when police started arresting doctors for prescribing opiates to addicts. Addiction was not yet considered a disease, so an addict technically wasn't a medical patient. Physicians soon stopped prescribing the drugs. People with real pain were left to endure. Addicts, meanwhile, turned to crime. "Because the addict is denied the medical care he urgently needs," one medical journal reported, "he is driven to the underworld where he can get his drug. The most depraved criminals are often the dispensers of these habit-forming drugs." A government campaign demonizing dope fiends followed, aided by a compliant media. The addict was a deviant, a crime-prone, weak-willed moral failure. This idea stuck and informed the view of junkies for decades. The mythic figure of the heroin pusher also emerged. He supposedly lurked around schoolyards and candy stores, giving youths habit-forming dope, hoping for future customers. With slight medical benefits compared to its high addiction risk, heroin ought to have passed into history. Instead, heroin replaced morphine on the streets. It thrived because it was tailor-made for dope traffickers. Heroin was easy to make and cheaper than morphine. It was also more concentrated and thus easier to hide and more profitable to dilute. The highs, and the lows too, were quicker and more intense than those of other opiates. An addict craved heroin several times a day and physically had to have it to function, so he was a terrific customer. Traffickers and mafias made heroin's career. New York established itself as the country's heroin center in part because the drug's early manufacturers were located there. Once heroin was made illegal, it came clandestinely through the city's port from Europe and Asia. New York's immigrants sold it on the street, Chinese and European Jews among them, and much later, Puerto Ricans, Colombians, and Dominicans. The logic of heroin distribution allowed New York to remain the world's principal heroin hub through most of the 20th century. While the drug came mostly from Asia, the Middle East, or Colombia, the drug was taken in at New York's port, distributed by endlessly replenished immigrant or black gangs, and from there sent up and down the East Coast and into the Midwest. Marijuana, like wine, has been hybridized into endless varietals, but heroin is a commodity, like sugar, and usually varies only in how much it's been cut, that is, diluted, or how well it's been processed and refined. Thus, to differentiate their product, dealers learn to market aggressively, and New York City is where they learned to do it first. Italians apparently led the way. In the 1930s, an aggressive new generation of Italian gangsters began infiltrating the drug traffic, replacing other groups, notably the Jews, wrote historian David Courtwright in Dark Paradise, his history of opiate addiction in America. Not only did the price increase, but the level of adulteration as well. New York's Italians pioneered heroin pushing, giving free samples to new customers. Their weak dope made injecting it popular. Injecting heroin sent what little heroin was in the dose directly to the brain, maximizing euphoria. Injecting begot nasty public health problems, among them later ferocious rates of hepatitis C and HIV. Mexican black tar added to them. Because tar is a semi-processed, less filtered form of heroin, the impurities that remain in the drug clog addict's veins when injected. Unable to find veins, addicts shoot it into muscles. Muscling black tar heroin, in turn, leads to infections, rotting skin, botulism, even gangrene. In the 1970s, East Coast heroin dealers, mostly blacks by then, began printing brands on glassine bags broadcasting the supposed potency of the drug inside, or the headlines of the day. Brands like Hell Date, Toxic Waste, Knockout, NFL, Obamacare, Government Shutdown. Over the decade, the drug that square America despised became the choice drug of despised America. Urban outcasts, wandering con men, homosexuals, pickpockets, artists, and jazz musicians populated the early heroin world. Underground classics such as William Burroughs' Junkie described its nonconformist Indians and mesmerized later generations intent on rebellion. But heroin was never about the romantic subversion of societal norms. It was instead about the squarest of American things. Business. Dull, cold commerce. Heroin lent itself to structured underworld businesses. Addicts had no free will to choose one day not to buy the product. They were slaves to a take-no-prisoners molecule. Dealers could thus organize heroin distribution almost according to principles taught in business schools, providing they didn't use the product, and providing they marketed. Stories about selling opiates quickly became tales of business models and the search for new markets. Easier than sugarcane. Jalisco, Nayarit. One afternoon in April 1996, a funeral procession left the village of Aquile Cerdan in the state of Nayarit, Mexico. Dozens of people trudged uphill, heading north to the town of Jalisco, the county seat, blocking traffic on the highway that also led south down to the beach resort of Puerto Vallarta. A banda, a brass band of trumpeters, clarinets, bass and snare drums, and a massive tuba, serenaded the marchers with "Te vas, angel mio," "You're leaving, my angel." Men fired guns in the air and took turns shouldering the casket that contained the corpse of a man named David Tejada. He grew up a ranchero kid, better off than some by rural Mexican standards. But by the time he died, his Andalusians and quarter horses were the finest animals in the county. He was also a master horse dancer. Horse dancing is a popular pastime among northwest Mexican rancheros. It involves spurring and prodding the horse to prance and hop in time to a banda staccato beat. At the county's annual Feria del Elote, corn fair, following the traditional horse parade that winds through Jalisco, David Tejada would display his horse dancing prowess to the admiration and envy of all. Now, as the men from his family carry Tejada's body to be buried, they also led his favorite animal, a white quarter horse named Palomo, saddled and riderless, and prodded it to dance as the banda played. For an hour, the procession moved up the highway, then over cobblestone streets to the Jalisco Cemetery. David Tejada was among the first from Jalisco County to sell heroin in the San Fernando Valley. Just as important, he was among the first to publicly display what black tar heroin could do for a ranchero kid. He built stables and attached them to the new large house he also built for his family. I heard about David Tejada well after I began piecing together the story of the Jalisco boys. By then, what began on the day that I stood on the banks of the Ohio River in Huntington, West Virginia, had turned into an obsession with the rancheros from this one small town of Jalisco, Nayarit. Thousands of Americans were addicted to the tar heroin the Jalisco boys sold that netted millions of dollars a month. I found nothing written about them. Yet I could see they were changing drug use in many parts of the country. I wondered how they wound up in so many places: Memphis, Omaha, Myrtle Beach, Nashville, Indianapolis, and Minneapolis. They reminded me, in fact, of another group I'd heard of, the Herreras. The Herreras were Mexico's first vast drug-trafficking ranchero family in the United States. They lived in and around a rancho known aptly as Los Herreras, an isolated roadless place in the mountains of Durango, founded in the late 1600s and accessible for centuries only on horseback. Like so many from the ranchos of Mexico, they were actually a clan, made up of numerous intermarried families. Navarez, Medina, Diaz, Villanueva, and Venegas were the other last names. They intermarried with the Corral family from the rancho Los Corrales. Law enforcement estimated the clan comprised 1,000 people, spreading across several ranchos in Durango, all involved in producing, transporting, or selling heroin. The first Herreras appear to have intended to work legitimately when they arrived in Chicago sometime in the 1950s. But poppies grew well in the mountains of Durango. In time, they moved to heroin. Much of the U.S. market was then supplied by Turkey, Afghanistan, and Southeast Asia half a world away, their dope coming through New York City. But after police dismantled the Turkish and European heroin network known as the French Connection in 1972, the Herrera clan grew into the most important source of heroin in much of the country, annually importing 7.5 tons of the brown powder known as Mexican mud. The Herreras were not really a cartel per se. It was an old-time organized crime family, said Leo Aragüin, a retired DEA agent I tracked down who infiltrated the clan in the early 1980s. Most Herreras looked like auto mechanics, scruffy and unassuming, driving beater cars, he said. Aragüin used to buy from one Herrera, who'd drive to the McDonald's meeting spot in a car so worn out that it burned oil and left a smoke cloud behind. One of the clan, Baltazar Navarez Herrera, owned a beef slaughterhouse in Chicago. For a while, the clan shipped its heroin in small metal tubes they fed the cows in Mexico. When the cows reached Chicago, they were slaughtered and the tubes retrieved, Aragüin said. The Klan moved to Denver, Detroit, Dallas, Oklahoma City, Los Angeles, and many other towns. Each Klan member was an independent entrepreneur, buying the family heroin. A Chicago police investigation into the Herreras estimated it took $60 million in profits out of that town alone, funneling all that to Durango through shady currency exchange shops around South Chicago. The Klan used its money, in part, to build parks and roads and other stuff that tends to endear villagers to narcos in the mountains of northwest Mexico. Directing the Klan was its patriarch, Don Jaime Herrera Navarez, a former police officer who never left Mexico. It's said that he had something to do with the reason that a Mexico ounce of heroin, known as a pedazo or piece, is actually 25 grams and not 28, which is the normal measure of an ounce. This difference has caused many disputes among buyers who, unaware of the difference, feel they're getting ripped off. Legend had it that Don Jaime had a large spoon holding 25 grams that he used to scoop heroin. That became a standard ounce in the Mexican heroin world. I never learned whether this legend, recounted by several older DEA agents who tracked the Herreras, was true. In 1985, Don Jaime, several brothers and cousins, and his son, Jaimito, along with dozens of other relatives, were busted. Many went to prison. That didn't end the Klan's activities, but they didn't have quite the same power. The shorter distances from Latin America to the United States, which allowed the region to remain more competitive in many agricultural commodities, eventually pushed out the Turkish and Asian heroin. Colombians began introducing their brown powder in the eastern half of the United States in the 1980s, along with their more famous cocaine. It was much cheaper than the white powder from Asia. Other Mexicans, including the Sinaloans, began sending black tar heroin north to the western United States in the early 1980s, replacing the Mexican mud. Even as the Herreras played a reduced supply role, heroin's price in America trended downward. Black tar, the most rudimentary form of heroin, was especially cheap to make. With Mexico so close by, tar's price could keep dropping. This, as I found out, was crucial to the story I came upon as I discovered the Jalisco Boys' networks. The Jalisco Boys seemed like a modern version of the Herreras, and as hard to get a handle on. I sifted through shards of information about their hazy underworld that came to me from indictments and interviews with addicts and cops, with prosecutors, DEA and FBI agents, and imprisoned Jalisco traffickers. Slowly, a picture emerged of how a small town of sugarcane farmers grew by the early 21st century into the most proficient group of drug traffickers America has ever seen. The first migrants from Jalisco settled in the San Fernando Valley, in Van Nuys, Panorama City, and Canoga Park. Many Jalisco migrants were there illegally, but worked legitimate jobs in construction, landscaping, and restaurants. However, by the early 1980s, a few families set to selling black tar heroin on valley streets and in parks. The opium poppy grew bountifully in the mountains above Jalisco, and these families had relatives who mastered the folk craft of cooking opium goo into black tar. Tar had the advantage of being moldable, like clay, and thus easy to shape into, say, the battery compartment of a boombox. Their tar was also potent and very condensed, and, as it was heroin, which addicts needed every day, it lent itself to retail, where the real profit was. The quantities needed were relatively small. A courier could take across a kilo in a purse or strapped under clothing. Jalisco families living in Tijuana hired themselves out as these couriers. The first Jalisco heroin traffickers mostly hailed from a single clan, many of whose members bore the last name, Tejada. Back in Jalisco County, the Tejada clan spread across several ranchos in webs of cousins, sisters, uncles, brothers, and in-laws. The last names also included Sanchez, Diaz, Ibarria, Lizama, Lopez, Navarro, Cienfuegos, Lerma, Bernal, Garcia, Hernandez, and others, knitted together through blood, marriage, and rancho life, the children of farmers, who also raised sugarcane, coffee, corn, and cattle. They were not the poorest of Jalisco's peon farm workers. On the contrary, they were people who had access to enough money to get up north, pay a coyote, and look for new kinds of work, said a Tepic professional I spoke with who was from Jalisco. Jalisquillo had many well-known sugarcane families. They were why Jalisco was first in production of sugarcane in the state of Nayarit. Their sons were the ones who started